Amen. Okay, well, brethren, here we are. Tonight, after some introductory material, we're going to look at what is, I think, by all accounts, without a doubt, everybody agrees, the toughest material in the book of Revelation. We're going to take out chapter 20. Not the longest chapter in the book, but I guess through the 40 years that I've been a Christian, I've seen at least a dozen very formal and comprehensive, you know, well-developed approaches to the book of Revelation. My library's got this many commentaries, you know, on the shelf there. And so as you read through all of these different approaches, though, it's been just curious and a little bit even comforting maybe to read that in every one of them, everybody says in chapter 20 that no matter what view you take, you've got problems. That nobody, in my way of knowing, has come up with a solution that gives us in chapter 20 the kind of confidence to just romp and stomp and say, you know, I absolutely know this is what the truth is. How many of you know Nick Nelson? Any of you know Nick? A few of you do. I think Jerry knows Nick Nelson. He's preaching over in Eastern Washington now for 25, 30 years, I guess. And had a conversation with him today. He's starting the book of Revelation and wanted to have, you know, my syllabus material so that he could hand that out to the class there. And he said, you know, I've got some minor differences with you, Larry, you know, but mostly we're in agreement there. Except when we come to chapter 20. So even people that agree with me, they don't agree with me when it comes to chapter 20. So I always hate, you know, feeling so helpless that way, because the rest of the book to me is really quite clear. The rest of the book to me seems so certain that I feel like I really can defend myself, you know, and argue for it. I'm pretty confident that I understand what the book's talking about. When we get to chapter 20, I'm reduced to, well, here is a list of possibilities, and I think it must be one of these. Knowing all along that I'm not sure which one it is, and there might be several more that I don't know about yet. So it's always a struggle in chapter 20. But as I say, a little bit comforting maybe that I've never met the man who didn't say that he had trouble too in Revelation chapter 20. Now, first though, before we get into it, you remember this chart from last week with regard to chapter 19. And beginning with chapter 17 and 18, we have the fall of the great harlot who is repeatedly responsible for the blood of the saints. We're told over and over and over again that this harlot is drunk with the blood of the saints, and her judgment is because of the blood of the saints. And we're rejoicing because the saints' blood is finally being avenged. And so chapter 17 and 18, fall of the harlot who is guilty of the blood of the saints. Then in chapter 19, in the first six verses, there's much rejoicing because she has fallen. They wanted that vengeance. They've been praying for that vengeance since chapter 6, in the fifth seal. And so it has been repeated several times throughout the book. So when she finally is punished for the martyrdom of the saints, there's great rejoicing that this punishment, long overdue, you know, finally comes to pass. Then, at that moment, the marriage feast begins. In verses 7 through 10, because this judgment has taken place, this is the start of the marriage feast. And so that marriage feast then not only begins right there, but it is also in verses 11 through 18 to continue. And we're given more information about it. Christ, in this period of time, is ruling with the rod of iron. So the marriage feast begins, it continues going on down through time, and Christ is the figurehead in that, who is ruling with a rod of iron. I suggested on the chart that I think these things all take place at 70 A.D. I think that we had a betrothal period before that time, that in effect, if you will, God had two wives for those first 40 years. The Old Testament system still stood. Most people in the world didn't even know, the Jews that is, about Christ. It would take years and years and missionary journeys before they would find out, you know, that Jesus had even died on the cross and risen from the dead. And during that time, they had no other recourse, no information had come to them to the contrary, but to, as Jews, continue to follow the law. So they did. And in that period of time, we have, I think, the betrothal period. Now, in 70 A.D., though, God, if you will, not only divorces, but puts to death this adulterous wife, by the way, it is a capital offense in the Old Testament, adultery. She's worthy of that death. She is killed. There is but one wife. The betrothal period is over. The marriage feast has begun, and we're going down through time to this day, inviting people to come to that marriage feast. That's your job and mine, and has been since for lo these many years. Then, in verses 19 through 21, remembering again, we're still in chapter 19, so the last three verses of the 19th chapter, the beast and the false prophet, which again, by fairly common agreement among the Lord's people, beast represents Rome, the beast and the false prophet are cast into the lake of fire. Does this happen at 70 A.D.? Does it happen at 410 A.D.? Does it happen at 455 A.D.? Does it happen in 476? Does it happen at the end of time? All of these have been proposed. Which is it? And again, no general agreement. 410, you have the Visigoth sack of Rome. That didn't amount to much. I think it was 3 days. 455, the Vandals are in, and they did it for 2 weeks. And in both cases, very limited. Not a lot of buildings are burned or anything like that. Not a lot of people die. They just, you know, pillage the place, take Rome's valuables. By 476, though, with the emperor at that time, another Augustus, surrendering, you know, all historians, I think, agree that by that time, Rome was over. You know, at least the western part of the empire, you know, is done, splits into two now. And so you have, you know, really the end of what we knew as the Roman Empire, at least, by 476. This one is very unlikely. So the Adventists and others will suggest the resurrected Rome and all of that. You know, I don't buy any of that at all. But regardless, for you and for me, all these dates, you know, are past. Rome went into the lake of fire. Rome went into the lake of fire after the woman that was writing it was destroyed. And Christ, immediately and at that time now, is ruling with the rod of iron. The marriage feast is continuing on down through time. Now, in 1920, though, I want to direct your attention there before we even read into chapter 20. If you look at chapter 19 and verse 20, the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet, who performed the signs in his presence, and by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword, which comes from the mouth of him who sat upon the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. Now, please note that the rest are not cast into the lake of fire at this time. A lot of people just seem to overlook this or to miss this, and so I try to make a special point out of it. In chapter 19 and verse 20, only the sea beast that the harlot was riding, and the earth beast, and these are terrible representations, you know, it's just for graphic sake, but the sea beast and the earth beast are cast into this fire. So the beast that the woman was riding, and the earth beast, which was setting up an idolatrous worship, you know, and promoting this idolatrous worship of the first beast, the sea beast, they go into the lake of fire, but nobody else does, not at this time. So as we're following the progression in these passages, you know, let's try to keep the chronological order, you know, in a line. And so at this point, the end of chapter 19, only those two go into the lake of fire. Okay. So if you will with me now, let's read from chapter 20. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the abyss, and shut it and sealed it over him so that he should not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark upon their forehead and upon their hand, and they came to life We'll have a very interesting observation about that verb in just a minute. Came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him. There's that reigning again. Reign with him for 1,000 years. There's the 1,000 years again. And when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. They came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil, who deceived them, was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And I saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. And the books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged from the things which are written in the books, according to their deeds. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and the death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every one according to their deeds. And death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Now clearly at chapter 21 and verse 1, we have this new vision now. It comes on the tail end of all these others, great long progression, at least 1,000 years in the vision has passed. And now we have a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away. There's no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. Well, we're back to a marriage feast then, aren't we? And so, interesting passage here, chapter 20, which appears in the symbology to be covering, you know, a significant period of time. And the beast, which at least if any of us are right, because we all agree, it represents Rome, has been destroyed. And Satan and the beast and this thing are in, you know, lake of fire, and it's sealed over, and there's nobody else in there. And all that time goes by, then he's released, and there's going to be deception again like there had been before, and we're going to have a final judgment scene. And then after all this is over, we come back to this new heaven, new earth, new Jerusalem, and we have, you know, a marriage supper. And so everybody's trying to work through this. What is this time frame that we're talking about? What are these players that are represented by these various things? And so that's the problem that everybody wrestles with. And how do we understand all of that? And I'll do the best I can with you here tonight and tell you what I understand about it. But at least this, I see nothing, brethren, in these verses that is going to undo any of the rest of what we've studied. And it's kind of like when I'm in Matthew chapter 24, you know, and I see this picture of the symbology that we have from the Old Testament. Sun, moon, stars are falling, and all of that. And you know, and then a few verses later it says, and all these things will happen in this generation. And I've said so many times, even if I'm wrong in how to understand verses 30, 31 and there, I know when it happened, even if I don't know what it represents, because the 34th verse tells us it had to happen in that generation. So I might struggle with, you know, how do I understand the symbology? But the time frame is ironclad. It has to happen in that generation or Jesus is a false prophet. So there's nothing in Matthew 24 that is going to undo the fact that have to take place in the first generation. And I feel much the same way about this chapter. Whatever's going on in this chapter, I don't think that we should throw away everything that, you know, we've seen so far to try to make this fit and then go back and adapt everything else. I'm thinking this is the one difficult part. It's 18 verses. And I see ways to understand it. I'm just not sure which of those to pick. So, you know, for all of my, you know, waffling, you know, here tonight, that I'm not so sure about this as I am in the rest of the book, I don't feel the least bit threatened in the rest of the book either. So here, let me give you an overview of what I think is happening, and then we'll go and we'll look at it verse by verse. Do you remember tonight that when I started the class, I said, we're going to be studying chapter what? 20. I started the class saying, we're going to study chapter 20. And then, what did I go back and read? 17, 18, 19, and finally now I'm coming to 20. Does this make me a liar or a sinner or, you know, some kind of inconsistent? I stated what I was going to do. I was going to teach chapter 20. Do I have a right as a teacher to anticipate the minds of my students and lay some groundwork or go back into some history or shed some kind of light, you know, take a path, you know, kind of a rabbit path or something? Do I have a teacher, as a teacher, have the right to say, this is what I'm going to do is study chapter 20 and then read something to you that's not in that chapter? Well, sure I do. Okay? So here's what I understand is happening here. The book begins emphatically and several times that these are events which are shortly to come to pass, twice in the first three verses. It then quotes in the seventh verse of the first chapter from Matthew chapter 24. And it quotes from a verse that precedes the passage that says all these things will happen in this generation. The book will then end in chapter 22, just a couple of chapters later, with repeated statements that Jesus is coming quickly, these things are shortly to come to pass. Don't seal up the book. That's how it begins, that's how it ends. And everything that I've been teaching you so far fits within those brackets. First century readers would expect that what they're reading would take place in the near-term future, would take place soon, shortly, near, quickly. So that's what I've been teaching. But as we've been looking at these visions, they are so catastrophic, so traumatic, so cosmic. You know, we got Satan in the form of casting stars down to heaven and out of heaven onto the earth, and all these things are going on, and it's just nothing, you know, but devastation and destruction. It is all about fire from heaven and rivers of blood and up to the horses' bridles. You know, there's just not a word in there you'd want a part of. You know, it's terrible. And so I'm thinking that what happened was is that God's infinite wisdom recognizes that he has both the right and I think even the responsibility as a master teacher, even I could do this, and I'm not near as good as he is, to say, now, time out. I just want you to know it's not the end of the world. The book is not talking about the end of the planet. It is not just talking about the end of all judgment. Earth is going to go on for quite some time. But since these events that are soon to come to pass are not the end of planet Earth and the whole universe, let me do for just 18 verses, 4.5% of the book. Let me just make a brief deviation from my stated bracket of things that are soon to come to pass, and let me tell you about the long-distance history up to the point of the final judgment. Everything I've been telling you about is soon to come to pass, but for 18 verses, I want to assure you that when all that is over, Jesus will be reigning with a rod of iron for a long time, and he will have the sword of the gospel coming out of his mouth for a long time. There will be a final judgment. 1,000 years is the term that he uses out there in the future. And these verses do talk about events that lie in our future. So, whether you're accepting what I'm teaching or not, as I've said so many times, it's fine with it if you don't. Jim Putterbaum's famous statement when we began the class, you know, introductory material, nobody's going to flunk out of heaven if they don't understand the book of Revelation. And I'm not going to fall out with anybody, none of my brethren who hold different views. That's perfectly fine with me. But to get my view, I would suggest that you go to chapter 19 and verse 19 and at least put in a note that says, Larry says, or something like that. Okay? Chapter 19, verse 19, through chapter 20, verse 15, which is all of chapter 20, speaks of the distant future and are the only verses in the book which do. Make a note to that effect somehow, whilst I embarrassed blow my nose. Sorry about that. Okay. So, this is what I think 1919 through 2015 is. An interlude. An aside. It is a parenthetical statement. There will be time after these events. The world's going to go on for a long time to come, and there will be a final judgment. What I've been telling you about is not the final judgment. What I've been telling you about is a soon judgment on Jerusalem. There will be a final judgment that will encompass the whole earth. And then, to set everybody's hearts at ease, I still believe that 1 Corinthians 15 is teaching a future judgment. I still believe there are passages like Acts chapter 1, verse 9 to 11 especially, which teach that Jesus will come back down on the clouds exactly the same way we left. The angel said so. I still entertain that hope. And so ultimately, I'm not really changing anything about views of a second coming, final judgment that is the end of all planet Earth and the end of time, which I think virtually, certainly everybody in this room already embraces. My understanding of the book of Revelation is only that we have missed a much more imminent judgment by misunderstanding the book and putting most of it out into our future and taking away then its meaning to the people of the first century. And we need to kind of reverse that. The book is not mostly about the end of the world, which the first century saints couldn't get anything from. It is mostly about the judgment on Jerusalem, which they would see in their generation. Then it has these 18 verses that are talking about the end of the world, or at least time going down through time to that point. And then it will immediately come back to its stated purpose and tell us about the marriage feast and Jesus reigning throughout the centuries to come in chapters 21 and 22, so that it can then end the book by saying these things are soon to come to pass, with the exception of these 18 verses. So let's come on back now. Look at chapter 20 and verse 1. I saw an angel coming down from heaven having the key of the abyss. So he's got a big key and a great chain. He's got a key and a chain. He laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and he bound him for 1,000 years. He bound him, tied him up. So he's wrapped in the chain somehow. And Satan is going to be, you know, restrained. Now, he's been portrayed in this vision this way since chapter 12, when he was introduced as being behind the power of the sea beast and the earth beast. All of it was, you know, satanic deception. So he's bound for 1,000 years. And then in verse 3, threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he should not deceive the nations any longer until 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Who went into the lake of fire first? In the visionary description, what went into the lake of fire first? The sea beast. The sea beast, brethren, in chapter 19 and verse 20. And who went in with him? The earth beast that caused the idolatrous worship of the sea beast. Those two were already there. Now Satan is thrown into this thing too. And it's sealed over. Now whether you pick 70 AD for this, which is fine with me, or you pick 410 or 455 or whatever, you know, fine. But Satan goes in after the fall of these two beasts. And when he does, this thing is capped. and nobody else goes in. Whatever that's about, it's not the end of the world. There's only Satan in there, the sea beast, Rome, and the earth beast, which was promoting idolatry. The false prophet is what it's also called. That's capped. Nobody else can get in there. Key in a great chain. Okay? And then in verse 4, well, verse 3, make sure we get this. You tell me, and I can't go any farther until you do, how was Satan bound? And don't say with a chain. In what way does the chain represent him being bound? We have an inspired interpretation of the symbol. What was he bound, prevented, restrained from doing? I'm deaf as a post. So you have to speak out.
He was restrained from getting out.
Truly can't get out, but that's not what I'm looking for. I'm here, Carol, first, I think.
He was restrained from doing evil.
Not really. Sorry. I think that takes us to the lead out.
He was restrained from power.
Nope. June?
Well, I think that means that he's restrained. He cannot force us to be evil. In other words, we're not inherently evil. Where as long as we have the blood of Christ, that wipes the weight of power.
Okay, you joined the group of these others who were totally wrong. I didn't see too many hands. Ron wants to make a stab at it.
So are you talking about the angel that comes down from heaven with the chain?
The angel comes down from heaven, has the chain, and he binds it. Half. When he goes down in here, half, you know, and it's capped in the lake of fire, what is it he cannot do anymore?
Deceive the nations.
That's what it is. That's the only description of how he's restrained. He cannot deceive the nations anymore. Now, you know, obviously, what does that mean? Well, and again, everybody has problems, but I'm not sure I know how to answer those questions either, pardon me. But that's the only restraint that's named. There was some sense in which Satan, and I think depicted in these beasts, was deceiving the what? The nations. Now, what would that be? I think it was through this idolatry that Rome had divine heads, you know, gods for kings and emperors and all of that, that comes to an end. Now, you can argue that that happened in 70 AD, and I'm all right with that. If you do, that's in sort of a spiritual sense. You know, we now know that Jesus is ruling and Christianity now is, you know, going out into the world eventually thanks to Daniel 2 and the picture of the stone and all that. We know that Christianity is going to have a profound impact on destroying Roman influence. So whether you kind of nail it down at 70 AD or you see it, you know, as a little bit later or whatever, that's the only thing that is said about how Satan is bound. The vision is that he's tied up, he's tossed into a lake of fire. What it means is that he can't deceive the nations anymore. So, again, we're going to bear this in mind, especially as we now come to these 1,000 years. What's that about? So let's read it in verse, well, at the end of verse 3, and then he's going to be released for a short time. So there's the long time, 1,000 years, and then there's a short time. Has that short time already happened? Has he been released already sometime in our past? Is that a future thing? These are the big questions, and they all revolve around understanding the 1,000 years. 4, verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. Now, almost universally, people go and leap to the judgment at the end of the world. I think that's a terrible mistake. It's before the 1,000 years here. So I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark upon their forehead and upon their hand. And they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. At this moment, after the two beasts had gone into the lake of fire, and then Satan himself had gone into the lake of fire, so he couldn't deceive the nations anymore, and the lake of fire is capped off. Nobody else can get in. Nobody else does get in. After that, see, or maybe simultaneously, I'd go either way, you have these thrones. And in verse 4, the souls of those who were beheaded because of the testimony, because of the word of God, did not worship the beast or his image, did not receive the mark of his forehead upon his hand. Who are they? When did we first hear about them? That's absolutely correct. When did we first hear about them?
Chapter 6,
verses 9 and 10, the fifth seal. I think that's them. They come to life and they reign with Christ for 1,000 years. Now turn back, everybody, please, to Revelation 5, verses 9 and 10, the chapter immediately before those people were introduced. Revelation 5, verses 9 and 10. And they sang a new song for living creatures and, you know, all those that were in the throne room scene. Verse 9, they sang a new song saying, "Worthy are you to take the book and to break its seals, for you were slain and purchased for God with your blood from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. You made them to be a kingdom and priest to our God." And brethren, I'm wondering, where will they reign? They're going to reign upon the earth. The verse says, reign upon the earth. If they reign upon the earth, no matter how you understand that word gaze, is it up in heaven that we're thinking because there is no earth anymore? Final judgment scene? So the earth has been vaporized and doesn't exist? Or are there still people on earth? There's still people on earth. Bill? Well, don't, because that's next week. I'm doing my work tonight. Sorry. And in fact, it'll take me 2 classes. I had told the elders I'd be done with Revelation before Brent's meeting. And in a sense, we will. But I'm going to have an auxiliary class that comes afterwards. It'll be the first class we have after the meeting. And we'll deal with that at great length, Bill, but not tonight. Carol.
If they're reigning on earth, do they have to be on earth? In other words,
dropped my water glass. It was empty. Nailed it, Carol. All right. Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. In 5, 9, and 10, they will reign, it says, upon the earth. Well, is Jesus reigning upon the earth now? Sure he is, but does he have to be here physically? No. But what does have to be here physically? The earth. He's got to be here. And so whatever we got going, brethren, the earth is still here. It's not, you know, a picture of the final judgment where it's rolled up like a garment and done away. Now, the reason I'm doing all that in chapter 5 is again, come back with chapter 20 and verse 4. Here we go again. They come to life and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. And then it says, and the rest of the dead don't come to life until 1,000 years are over. This is the first resurrection. Blessed is and holy, verse 6, is he who has a part in the first resurrection. Over those of second death has no power. They'll be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations. That's the only way he was restrained. When he's now released, he comes back to do it again. He'll come out to deceive the nations, which are in the four corners of the earth. Gog and Magog. You look in your notes for an understanding of Gog and Magog. I give you ideas there, you know, and you don't want to get into that. It's a difficult term. But Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth, surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Fire came down from heaven and devoured them. The devil who deceived them, who was in the lake of fire for 1,000 years after the beasts had been tossed in ahead of him, he's now unable for 1,000 years to deceive the nations, but he's just been released for a little while. When he gets released so he can do that again, we now have this great war. And now, you know, the camp of the saints and beloved city, fire from heaven and all that. And now, in 10, the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. Note that when Satan comes back out, the beast and the false prophet don't. So he's tossed back in where they stayed, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And I saw a great white throne, him who sat upon it, from whose presence the earth fled away, no place was found for them. And then we have another judgment. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, when I knocked that over, because
doesn't run over.
I'll try to knock this one over while it's full. I've done that once already, and none of you even know whether I soaked this whole thing up here and you even let on. Okay, so what I'm saying is that at the end of verse 4, I believe that during the 1,000 years, whatever that means or represents, that the earth is still here. Jesus is in heaven, but he's reigning upon those who are on the earth. And throughout this length of time, which is 19 verses 11 through 18, you have him reigning with a rod of iron and destroying the nations and people coming to Christ. And I think that stretches far beyond 1,000 literal years to, as a matter of fact, at least twice that amount. Because in 20 and verse 5, the rest of the dead don't come to life until the 1,000 years are completed, and this is the first resurrection. So, you know full well, 1,000 years is a millennium. The question is, what does that term represent? Now, if you've learned anything from me, you've learned in the course of this class that I believe one of the most fundamental, you know, rules of biblical or any other kind of hermeneutics is that you should take a term in its literal sense unless there's something that in the context or elsewhere that would cause you to think differently. So throughout this book, I've been really harping on these time references. I've been maintaining, you know, very vigorously that they mean what they say. That these time references are not symbolic of something else. That the time references help us to identify what the symbols represent. And now I'm going to make a liar out of myself. Okay? This is the one term in the book that I do not believe is intended to be used literally. Now, first though, you try it. Does the 1,000 years start with the resurrection of Christ? What happens in 1030? Can't find anything. Does it start in 70 AD? Well, what happens in history in 1070? I don't know. Nothing that would fit, Satan coming out and all that. You know, nothing seems to work. Well, how about 1410 or 1455 or 1476? Let's add 1,000 years to each of the possibilities for the fall of Rome then, you know, and we'll go with that. Well, and again, what do you have? And I've looked at a lot of commentaries and talked to a lot of brethren, and by common agreement, we all say, it doesn't work. If you go with 1,000 years and then try to find resurrections in first and second, you know, and all that, it just doesn't seem to be anything that fits. So now I am being kind of derivative. Where before, everything was fitting this shortly, soon, near, come to pass, you know. Why doesn't this one? Now, brethren, I think there's a good reason for it, though. So at this point, this is really critical. Get your pencil or pen out. I'm going to give you four passages, all of which are in the Psalms. These four passages you should put either in your margin at chapter 20 and verse 2, or you could put it at the end of verse 4 if you wanted, or you could put it at verse 6, you could put it at verse 7, you could put it in any one of those places where the term 1,000 years is used. But write these four verses down. The first one is Psalm 50. They're all in Psalms. Psalm 50 and verse 10. In Psalm 50 and verse 10, I have a biblical Old Testament use of 1,000. Maybe this will help me to understand how God would use this number. Now, bearing in mind, I had some serious problems before trying to find a biblical passage, you know, for 7 or for 10 or for 12 and some of these other numbers. But in this case, I've got something with the 1,000 that leads me not to take it literally. Psalm 50 and verse 10 says, every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. Every beast of the forest is mine, God speaking, the cattle on a thousand hills. Now you know what that means. God only owns the cattle in Washington, because there's more than a thousand hills up there, and he doesn't own a single bovine creature in Oregon. Right? No. When he said, I own the cattle on a thousand hills, what did he mean? Beyond all doubt, and he said, so in the passage, all beasts are his. So, in this passage, he uses the thousand, but he also identifies the fact that he intends it to be understood as being 100%. Every beast of the forest is his. The cattle on a thousand hills, and on hill 1001, and all the rest. There are hundreds of thousands of hills just in America, let alone the rest of the world. He owns the cattle on all of them. Now, come and look at, so when you want to look, you're writing it down, Psalm 84 and verse 10. Coincidentally, verse 10 again. This time, Psalm 84. And the verse says, a day in your courts is better than a thousand outside. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. Now, how many days in a year? 365. If you multiply that by 3, you will get more than what? You get more than 1,000. Okay? So, 3 years is more than 1,000 days. And, of course, we're led to understand in verse 10 that a day in God's court is better than 2.5 years outside his courts. But if somebody offered you 3 full years outside his courts, that would be better than a day in God's courts. Right? Again, nobody thinks that, nor should they. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness. So here again, God, by inspiration, is using the term thousand, and we are given to understand unquestionably it refers to something larger than 1,000. It's just a nice round number that means full, complete, total, you know, all of them. All right? I have an inspired definition to that effect. For all these other numbers, I don't, but for this one, I do. And so now I'm inclined to accept this usage of that term 1,000 because I see God using it that way rather than literally. The next psalm is 90 and verse 4. Remember, now Psalm 90, it appears, was written by Moses. This is not David now. This is Moses, well before David. And in Psalm 90, it's verse 4. 1,000 years in your sight. Well, there's the very term 1,000 years. 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by. 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by. How is he using the term 1,000 years? Well, if, you know, we're right that let's just pick a number, let's say the earth is 10,000 years old and 1,000 years is like a day, so to God, the earth's only been around for 10 days. Okay? Is that really what he was trying to teach, that we should use this as a literal equal sign and try to plug it in somewhere else? You know, I don't think so. I think 10,000 years in his sight is also like yesterday. And I think 50,000 years is like yesterday. And I think 10 million years is like yesterday. Because infinity to God, which is what he is, an infinitely existing being, an eternal being, is like what in time? Well, you can't compare it to time. But when he does compare it to time, he picks 1,000 as the terminology. And I thought I saw a hand go up here somewhere. Anybody? There it is, Bill.
Time is insignificant to God, but to us, 1,000 is a big number. That's something significant to us.
Exactly. And that's what I think is happening here. especially in this passage, Bill's really hit it on the head. You two sitting right one behind the other, you know, you're infecting each other with brilliance. Okay, careful, Bill there. You both hit nail on the head. You know, that's right. Where 1,000 years will seem like a big length of time to us, what is it to God? So he needs to use that comparison to help us understand that to him it's no big deal. Okay, the last one now is in Psalm 105 and verse 8. Psalm 105 and verse 8 says, he has remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, the covenant which he made with Abraham and his oath to Isaac. He remembered his covenant, and that's the one to Abraham and Isaac, forever, and the word that he commanded to 1,000 generations. Brother, I don't care how you go in and start working with it, you're not going to find that the length of time that Moses' law, or even from Abraham rather, you know, up to the time of Christ, that covenant lasted for 1,000 generations. Not literally. If so, it would be on the order of something like 40,000 years then. Generation, typically about 40 years. 1,000 generations, 40,000 years. Literally. Moses' law was in effect 1,500 years. The covenant with Abraham is about 400 years older than that. Okay? You got about 1,900 years. Then Christ does away with it at the cross and in his resurrection. And so this covenant first was not eternal, even though the word forever is used. And it's also not 40,000 years. But he said, to 1,000 generations. Then what did he mean? He meant, for as long as that covenant is supposed to last. And I mean forever, as long as I intended it to last. That's why this term is best translated, age lasting, and not think eternal or forever like we do. Okay, Bill? I will grant they are not all Israel who are of Israel, and we are a new Israel, if you will. And so, yeah, and I'm fine with that. But it'll come to the same thing, won't it? That it wasn't intended to mean that you would count the years and it comes to an end on that year. And if so, it hasn't come to an end yet, you know. And okay, that would work, but when does it? You know, and so it's open-ended is what I'm trying to get at. And that's what you're saying, I think, too. So, yeah, even if you include, in a spiritual sense, Christians as well as Jews, the term still means the same thing, which is, it is not to be understood literally. It's to be understood as meaning, for long as God says so. Okay? Very quickly, Bill, I'm all out of time now. Amen.
This 1,000 years we're talking about tonight not be an actual 1,000 years.
Exactly. I don't think it's a literal 1,000 years. But it's just meant to tell those saints the same thing that told them back in the Old Testament 4 times. See, the church is going to go on for a long time. Don't worry about it. It's not the end of planet Earth. So, you're going to have, you know, this period of time, unspecified, but large period of time, where all these events are going to unfold out there in the future. But all the near-term stuff is going to be cataclysmic because it's the end of the Jews, it's the end of the Old Law, it's the end of the Old Covenant, it's the end of Jerusalem, it's the end of the Temple, it's the end of all those things. Now, I only have 5 minutes left, and I'm really determined to finish this chapter tonight, so there'll be no more charts either. Let's just go directly to the book. The next big question, and really the only other big question that we have now, is what are we going to do with these first and second resurrections? What happens there? So in verse 5, the rest of the dead, so not the ones that had been martyred for Christ, but the others. These are dead, but they are not the ones that are described in verse 4. These are the ones down through time, throughout this 1,000 years, which I take to be now 2,000 literal years, you know, down to our day. They don't come to life until after that. And that's the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power. But they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for how long? 1,000 years. Now, I think all of these people, they're not living each of them 1,000 years. They're only living a normal lifespan. But throughout this unspecified large period of time, it's called 1,000 years symbolically, you have people coming to Christ. And they're living and reigning on the earth. So what is this first resurrection then, where this is happening? Look at your notes. I'm suggesting that it represents being baptized into Christ. But I'm ambivalent about that. I think there are 6 possibles at least, and since I did these notes just today, I thought of a 7th. Give me time, I'll get it then. You know? I wish I could really nail it down, but I could see 2 or 3 that I'd be happy with. So right now, you know, I'm 51% in favor of the idea. It's just talking about people being baptized into Christ. Because, if you look at my notes, that is the first possible resurrection. It's a new birth. Number 2 is the one Art Ogden suggests, that it is life after death, like Luke 16 suggests, where even though you've died and gone to Hades, you're still alive. He thinks it refers to that time that people are in there. I don't. Verse 2. The third possible resurrection, the third possible resurrection is the physical one that's taught by premillennialists. I'm not going to get into that. It's ridiculous. It doesn't have any support in Scripture at all. You know, there's no truth in that. And anybody in the Lord's people, I think, even tempted by it. Number 4, the fourth possible resurrection is a spiritual one in which we say, well, it's just that Christianity triumphs over evil and is successful in history and Rome will fall, the church's kingdom that gates of Hades cannot prevail against. This was Foy Wallace's approach, but again, you know, it's unconvincing for me at least. Number 5, the fifth possible resurrection is a spiritual raising of dead saints because of Christ's sacrifice. And number 6 is the sixth possible resurrection, that of a future final judgment of the whole planet, which again, last one I just think is not going to fit this, you know, scenario at all, not for a first one if we're going to have a second one. So you work with that. And then I say, they all have strengths and weaknesses, but I vote for number 1 because baptism in Christ, the new birth, is indisputably your first possible resurrection. Second death will certainly have no power over all faithful Christians, like 20 verse 6 suggests. The saints are priests of God in chapter 20, verse 6. So here, you know, while we're here in this physical life, and they reign with Christ here in this physical life, as we read in Revelation 5, 9, and 10. So these are people who are united with Christ and working with him, whether they're alive or dead, down through the now 2 millenniums that we've had since the church was established, and is referred to as 1,000 years in which Christ is reigning. The symbol is being used just to say to those saints, all this stuff that's soon to come to pass is not the end of everything. There's this that'll take place too. Now, let's come back to verse 7. And when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison, will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, now called Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. Here's this other war. Number of them is like the sand of the seashore. They come up on the broad plain of the earth. They surround the camp of the saints, the beloved city. Fire comes down from heaven and devours them. I think this is some future war in which Satan has been released for a little while. My view is that he hasn't been yet. And that when this happens, we'll have again in our future something like what the saints had in the first century, with a great, powerful political force that is deceived by Satan, and maybe in quasi-religious terms too, into persecuting the saints. But they're going to fail. Now, 10, the devil who deceived them is thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone. Now, bear in mind, that's the second time he's going in there. He was in there, he came back out, now he's going in again. Where the beast and the false prophet are, and always had been, since chapter 19, verse 20. And they'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. And I saw a great white throne and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. So now, after Satan is cast back into this sea of fire, along with the beast and the false prophet who never left it, now in verse 12, now after that, I saw the dead, the great and small, standing before the throne. Books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. The sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. They were judged, everyone according to their deeds. And death and Hades now were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he's thrown into the lake of fire. Now, brethren, there's 1,000 years, however you understand the term, between the beasts going into the fire and Satan going into the fire, and then Satan coming out 1,000 years later for a little while and going back in again after the little while. And then, I should be going the other way for your sake, over here, from right to left your way, you know, is the final judgment, which has not happened yet. This is the only place in Revelation where you are talking about the end of planet Earth. Death will no longer be. Hades will no longer be. Okay? We still have death. We still have Hades, don't we? So this can't have happened yet. But it will. I don't think Satan's out deceiving the nations yet. I think when he does, it's going to be as bad as the persecutions that Satan experienced under Rome. I don't think that's happened yet. But I know the final judgment hasn't happened. The second resurrection, brethren, will be the one when all the dead come up. The righteous speak the word in the air and all of that. So that hasn't happened yet. But if you go through the first resurrection, if you're baptized into Christ and you rise to walk in newness of life, you will have no fear of the second death. Okay? You will have no fear of the lake of fire. You will reign with Christ. Then, at the final judgment, you're not going into that lake of fire. Only those who never served Christ throughout all these 1,000 years after we had the judgment and the vengeance for the blood of the saints that took place in chapter 17 and 18. So I hope that's clear for you. It took me, you know, a couple of extra minutes. I know it's kind of struggling here. But I hope you'll see that the scenario I'm proposing certainly works. It's just that I'm not as dogmatic about it. I can see a couple of ways it'll work. I'm not sure which one to pick. So I might change my mind a little bit in there. But it's going to all fit the same thing. Then, next week, we'll come to chapter 21. Please read this week as your assignment, Isaiah 65 and 66. Read this week, Isaiah 65 and 66. And next week, we won't even talk about Isaiah, but I want to get it in your head. And then we'll talk about Revelation 21 and 22. We'll finish the book hopefully next week. We'll have our meeting with Brent the week after that. And then after the meeting with Brent, we're going to come back and do a whole class that studies nothing but Isaiah. And I hope when I get done with Isaiah as the capper on the book of Revelation, that you're going to be very confident what this new Jerusalem, new heaven, new earth is all about. Whatever it is in Isaiah is what it is in Revelation. Okay? Any comment or question? Good, you know. Not really. Anybody, we were over time anyways. Anybody can't sleep tonight, Greg?
If we say that this is the future, what's stopping us from saying, well, 1,000 years is in the future too, and they're really going to reign on the earth premillennially? What's really stopping us?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I understand your question, but if I do, nothing then. You know, except the other teachings in the rest of the Bible. A premillennial thing falls in about 40,000 different ways. And so, just because I allow that this 1,000 years is a symbolic term, because that's the way it's used in the Old Testament, doesn't open any doors to premillennialism, I don't think. Anybody else?